I'm here with Pablos. Hello, Pablos.
Hi there.
Good you find the time to talk with me here. You are... Well, maybe you can just explain yourself what you what you are and what you do.
Well, something's wrong because people are constantly asking me to explain myself.
Yeah,
which apparently
I
isn't
apologize.
Going very well. It's okay.
You can make it short.
Well, I think for for your purposes, I'm a kind of inventor. I work on a lot of wacky R&D projects, trying to apply rapid prototyping and rapid development concepts to specifically like from the software industry and software development, I should say, to developing electronics and robotics and other things with new materials that interest me in particular, some of which is for product development and other things just private for private clients that want something new and interesting. And so over the years, I've worked on a lot of kind of different projects, but now I've got a lot of that was software development, and over time I got more interested in building actual stuff. So I'm into building things, and a lot of my
How long are you doing it? When did you start?
Well, I think it's kind of been a progression. I mean, most of my work was software until about 4 years ago, and then I was working on the OQO, which we built the world's smallest PC. It's basically like a laptop but fits in your pocket and has the same features as a laptop and runs Windows XP like a laptop, but it's just tiny. And with that in particular and the project before that, I was working on building spaceships at Blue Origin. All of it really just got me enthralled with making physical stuff, building stuff that you could, play with and show people and feel, and it wasn't so mysterious as software. And so after that, I just kind of kept with it and started looking for more of the kinds of projects where I get to build things in lots of different ways and applying lots of new tools and using computers to run tools that we can use to do things. And so for me, it's, especially in software, there's always kind of a theme of security with the work I'd done. And so we got really into hacking with computers, years and years ago. And then we would sort of take the time to always develop cool new hacks and show them, especially at hacker conferences and things where we could kind of share those things, which are kind of inspirational in a way, but also... to try and help with making computers more secure. And I think, go ahead.
We're at the DLD conference here today. You gave a talk, and I know you didn't choose the title, but the lecture was running under the name Hackers Inc.
Yeah.
And you showed a variety of projects that you did. I know you're not too happy with the title. Were you?
Oh no, it's just I'm fine with the title. I don't know what it means, but it's what I'm trying to do here is take some of the things that we've that we've developed at hacker conferences and things that are demonstrations of security vulnerabilities. And what I try to do is pick the ones that are fun and interesting that I can demo and then show them somewhere like this where it's a less, it's not a technical conference. This is an audience that's not hackers. They haven't seen those things before. And so it's interesting to them because it's all new. And it's also interesting to me to show them because it helps people not have a false sense of security about the things they use, their cell phones and their computers and things. But the real reason I would show these things here is inspirational. I want people to see what hackers are up to and see the kinds of things that are possible when you have the mindset that hackers have. And I would characterize that as being very... very fluid and free and open to all kinds of possibilities. And so with hackers, we're taking things apart and breaking them and finding out what all the pieces fall out of them. And then we figure out what we can make out of those pieces and build something new. And so to me, the spirit of hacking is so closely related to the spirit of innovation and that discovery process that's necessary to do new things. And I think that's something that a lot of, you know, our companies aren't really good at. And in particular, it's part of why they're not good at making cool products. You know, a lot of the things that a lot of companies are making really suck, and it's because they don't have a soul in them. They just were made from a feature list of things that they thought the market wanted, but they don't behave like something I would really want to use, because they weren't made by people who wanted to use them. And so what I'm in a sense sort of trying to do is both encourage companies to value the hackers they have and get them out of computer security department and put them in the product development department, and give them the freedom to just play, and instead of telling them to, you know, not do any of that stuff at work, you know, tell them to come to work and break everything and try and come up with something new. And then through that discovery process, they'll find something worth putting into products. And that's what I think is sorely missing. And we used to kind of solve that just by doing it in startups, but it's really been tough, at least in Silicon Valley, I think, and in the U.S. in particular, to have startups that are crazy enough to really do innovative things these days. And everybody has had so much experience with them, and they've been through it before, and they know what all the problems are, that everything that can go wrong, and they know what not to do. And so by the time you don't do everything that you're not supposed to do, you're left with nothing. And so I think it's tough for startups to be innovative enough these days. And
you mentioned that you showed things that you're usually showing at hacker conferences. Mm-hmm. So which conferences in particular are talking about?
Well, over the years, we've spent the most time, myself along with the Shmoo group, which is a kind of hacker group. We have shown most of our stuff at DEF CON over the years. And that's the one we kind of invested ourselves in the most. But we're big fans of some of the other hacker cons that have gone on. We love TourCon, and we love some of the other smaller hacker cons. CodeCon was great, although, you know, less about security, and that's what I think is good about them, is kind of rescuing hackers from security and getting them back into building stuff is really important to me, and I think some of these conferences are doing that. And so when we started ShmooCon a couple of years ago, we specifically tried to design it so that it would help with that, you know, and help. And it is a security conference. It is important the focus is on security, but we built it. We set up ShmooCon with separate tracks for what we called the break it track, which is all the tracks about vulnerabilities and finding flaws with stuff and helping to just break everything and show how it's broken. And then we have a build it track, which is the track for speakers who have cool stuff they want to show that they've built, that they've made, and all those innovative concepts that come out of that. And I love that aspect of ShmooCon, and I think that's, you know, to me, that's the most like important idea behind it, is like, how do we recognize that hacking's about so much more than security issues, and it's about this mindset that lends itself to building cool shit. So that's what I'm trying to do.
So ShmooCon is an annual conference?
Yes, in Washington, D.C.
When is it usually going on?
It's March this year.
Okay, so still enough time
to
plan on the
publishing. Yeah, we got really lucky, and it's been very successful and popular, and it's tough to get tickets, but it's...
How many
We let 800 people in, and it's... We're not trying to grow specifically, so it's hard to keep, because we don't want it to get too big. But I think they have like 800 or 1,000 is the limit this year. I don't know exactly.
But it's on a first come, first serve basis.
Yeah, well, we have a weird scheme for buying tickets where they've actually allocated. You could buy some in December and some in January and some in March, but so like on the first of each month, I think we sell some tickets, but they sell out in a few minutes. So you kind of get out of bed and sit in front of your browser and wait for them to go on sale to get them, which is it's charming. I mean, I'm really happy that we don't have the opposite problem, and it's sad that it's tough for some people to get in, but I mean, to keep the quality, we just can't let it grow too fast. So
so you said the ShmooCon is organized by the Shmoo group.
Well, it's actually, I mean, to be fair, yeah, so the Shmoo group is, you know, sort of I suppose like you know, like the Loft or other hacker groups from that we, you know, used to have. And I think that, you know, we're just like the one that's still around, you know, because it's hard to do anything organized with a bunch of anarchists for a long period of time. And so the Shmoo Group over the years has done a lot of projects mostly related to hacktivism or hacker activism and showing security flaws. And we've, you know, some of our famous projects aside from like the HackerBot are like Air Snort, which was an early tool for showing web cracking. And then we make like OSIRIS, which is a host intrusion detection tool, you know, open source app. And then we have Air Snarf, which is showing how to do captive portal man-in-the-middle attacks on Wi-Fi. We have, you know, a lot of the time we've just made these different tools and made different demonstrations of vulnerabilities and then tried to figure out, you know, to me in particular, I spent my efforts in trying to figure out how do we publicize these issues, because even, you know, it's what's sad to me in a way is the things I'm showing here at DLD are, you know, not interesting at hacker conferences because they've seen it all. It's all a couple years old, you know. But when I come to an audience like this, which is not paying attention to hacker cons, they haven't seen any of it. And so I can show 3-year-old attacks on Wi-Fi or Bluetooth or something, and it's going to be interesting to this crowd. And that's, you know, to me that just shows that we're not doing a very good job of letting the public at large know about the security problems. And I think they need to know, because we have done a good job at letting vendors know over the years, and with mixed degrees of success, and we really haven't been successful at getting vendors to buy into the security issues. I think it's improving over time, but a lot of times they don't want to face them.
The Shmoo Group, is it a regional?
No, the Shmoo Group is all. It's mostly, I have to say, it's mostly the U.S., but we have some folks in, you know, in Europe. We have Ben Laurie is in England, and he's in the Shmoo Group, and we have Adam Shand who's in New Zealand. We have a few guys from different countries in there, but it's mostly all in the U.S., and they're kind of split between the East Coast and the West Coast.
So how do you establish communication?
We just have, you know, we have the Shmoo Group list, and everybody just gets on the list, and we just bitch about whatever we want and and decide what we want to do next. And we've done that for years. You know, we sort of, I think when we started the Shmoo Group, the only way to do it would be an email list. And so.
Okay. But you said it's, you know, we should sort of get security out of the main focus.
Yeah.
Now you were talking about lots of security tools. So
right.
Is there, what are the other aspects apart from making things?
Right.
Is there also a political part in this community that plays a role?
I'm not sure I understand what you're asking about. I mean, I think it's true that I think that hackers can spend their talents on other things more, you know, that are more valuable than just security issues. We have institutionalized a lot of the ways that you reduce security problems. So, for instance, five or 10 years ago, you just couldn't get anybody to let you audit their code. You had to, try to convince them that would be a good thing to do to make their software more secure, and they just did not. They would put it off, and they didn't want to hear about it. They didn't want to spend money on it. But now that security issues are more well known, especially in the U.S. market, and we have regulatory compliance issues for some big companies, they do have a budget for security. They are putting effort into getting their applications looked at, so we can get companies to audit their code and hire security experts to do that. And I think that as we do that, we're getting it into the realm of a business. You know, we're getting it into the realm of a ongoing service. You need hackers to always be showing you what the problems are, but then you need that, you know, security consulting industry to go and take that to every company, to every application, to every device, and make them secure. And it's hard, you know, it's hard. And you can't ever be completely secure, but you have to be diligent. And so
So how does the group relate to the open source movement? Is this like just two things going well with each other, or is it very strong?
The Shmoo group in particular is, you know, very enthusiastic about open source stuff, and we've made some open source software and
open source or free software.
Yeah,
even.
Both. I mean, yeah, the software we've made has all been free, and I'd like to have, you know, done more of it over the years, but the hard part, I think, is building an open source app is a tough problem, and for me in particular, I'm good at doing the first version of something, but sticking with it, you have to build an ecosystem to support it. It's really amazing to me how well that's worked out for, you know, for the big open source apps in particular, like Apache and whatnot. And I think the problem, you know, part of the problem with using open source software on the whole is that you got a lot of pieces of it that really there's one guy behind it. You know, a lot of open source apps is just one guy who's pouring his life into it, you know, usually for, you know, in a lot of cases with no economic support. And that guy has a lot of the application in his head, you know. And even though we have the source, it's not really easy for somebody else to go work on it. And that's partly, you know, that's partly to do with the languages we've used over the years and partly to do with the way computers are architected. It's not so easy to go muck with somebody else's code. But it's possible, and that's a good start, you know. So
when I was asking about political issues, it's also probably how the Shmoo group or the overall community, not really only focusing on this particular group here, relates to the public and relates to the media in terms of being a hacker and doing hacker things.
Right. So for us, I mean, the things we took on really early had to do with, crypto, for example, was a big issue for us in the 90s when we were trying to figure out, you know, how do we solve this problem we had in the U.S. where the government had outlawed the use of strong crypto, especially for export. So you couldn't export software that would do strong cryptography. And we thought that, you know, it was particularly bad position because we wanted to be able to communicate with people all over the world. And we wanted to be able to have confidence in the crypto. And that was one problem where I think collectively community as a whole with, you know, tiny minor contributions from the Shmoo group got enough attention to really affect the legislation, and that was fixed, you know. So now we have solved that problem. We moved on from there into issues related to reverse engineering and privacy issues. To me, reverse engineering is fundamental. It's crucial. Everything you learn has to be from observation, and that's where, you know, that's where progress comes from. So it's completely asinine that that we've allowed some things like the DMCA to try and put limits on reverse engineering. And so to us, that's something worth working on. And we, you know, like one of the things we worked on was a friend of ours was in the U.S. was arrested and put in jail for reverse engineering the copy protection scheme in Adobe's software and in PDF in particular, and he was a Russian citizen who visited the U.S.
We're talking about the Skolarov.
Yeah, this
case.
Is Dmitry Skolarov,
right.
And so Dmitry came over and just showed his work, which in fact was really fascinating because what he was showing is that the security mechanism, like the password protection mechanism for the PDFs, wasn't secure at all. It was really easy to break. And this is a case where you have a massive, you know, relatively massive software company that we loved. You know, Adobe's made great products over the years. And I personally have loved using Adobe products over the years. But to me, it was really sad because what they did is they asked the feds to step in and arrest him for a DMCA violation. So he was the first guy prosecuted for a DMCA violation. And, under the auspices of reverse engineering. And the situation there was that they were selling a product specifically saying that this is a security product. You know, you put a password in and we're going to keep your PDFs secure. Well, you know, you're not getting what you think you're paying for. And you have no way personally of assessing, I mean, it's complicated stuff, so I can't necessarily determine that it's insecure. You need experts who can figure that out. And in this case, you know, you've got a Russian researcher who's doing it for free and letting the vendor know and letting the public know, the customers know. And I think that that's delightful. It's wonderful. It's exactly the process that we should have. And what should happen is Adobe should thank him and they should fix the problem and move on. But instead what happens is they're, you know, trying to take these, what, you know, what I think are...
punish the deliverer of the bad news.
They're trying to punish the messenger, and also they're using these unconstitutional laws that we've managed to sneak in the DMCA in particular. And it's really sad state of affairs. So we got, you know, livid about these things and put a lot of work into getting Dmitry freed, and we did. But, you know, the guy lost at least 6 months of his life when he had to stay in California, partially in jail or there for various court issues until he could go back home to his family in Moscow. And he's got two kids and a wife over there. I mean, it was a really sad, really sad experience. And so I, you know, it's something I put a lot of effort into at the time because I was trying to help him out, and I shouldn't have had to do that, you know. And so anyway, you know, moving forward, like past that experience, you know, the Shmoo Group has tried to, you know, I think with Wi-Fi in particular, we got pretty interested in trying to show the flaws in both the protocol and in various implementations in Wi-Fi, because it got so, you know, it got so popular so fast and everyone was using it with really no understanding of the security issues. I mean, at the very basic level, it's just putting up an access point and having it completely open is a liability. I mean, it's a risk to a user, and it's okay. I think open Wi-Fi is great, but you just got to know what the implications are, and people don't. So we put some effort into that. Unfortunately, the encryption standards for Wi-Fi were not as secure as people imagined, and so, you know, we have to show exactly how long it takes us to break the encryption so that people know what they're using. And unfortunately, it's not just WEP. You know, they went back and revisited it with WPA, and I think very soon you're going to start seeing the same kinds of attacks that are possible on WPA. And so people just need to know it's a moving target. Security is a moving target. The things that you rely on require a deeper understanding. When you
say you showed and you published, who did you show it? What were your experiences, with media?
So for us, we, you know, the first, initially, what we would do with these things is, you know, show something at DEF CON to 1,000 people in the audience or whatever, and then we would, you know, maybe release a tool to demonstrate or something. But we were just showing it to geeks, and it really. And even if we managed to get any press about it, it would just be like the press that covers computer security, which only geeks read. And there's really no, you know, it was very insular. So then we got sort of more creative about it. And I would like to say it was totally strategic, but I don't think it was. We wanted to build a robot. Eric and I, another guy in the Shmoo Group, wanted to build a robot. And so we bought some wheels on eBay and started building a robot, and then got halfway into it and said, well, what's the point of building this robot? You know, we don't need a robot to fetch beer for us, so we have to come up with a reason to say, well, I don't know, what do we normally do? Well, normally we're hacking. So, okay, great, we'll build a hacker robot. So then we built this robot, and it was called the HackerBot, and the HackerBot could drive around and find Wi-Fi users, and then it could drive up to them and show them their passwords on the screen. And the thing about the HackerBot was that it turned out to be a really instructive lesson, because it wasn't doing anything that you know a geek with a black T-shirt and a laptop couldn't do. But the HackerBot got printed in the New York Times and the Washington Post and on CNET. It was like all over the place, and it got a lot of attention because it was a cute little robot, you know. And so people like robots, and it makes it more interesting. And it made the whole issue of Wi-Fi security more mediagenic, and so now people were paying attention. So after that, we learned to sort of embody our messages in much more interesting ways. And
in a media compatible
fashion. Yeah, in a media compatible fashion. There you go. And so I was quite happy about that. I mean, I felt the HackerBot itself was charming. I mean, you know, it's a nefarious robot that's stealing your passwords, but people just thought it was cute. And they're like, oh, look, a cute robot. Look, it has my password. Isn't that charming? So, you know, I think there's some fun to it, and we try to keep it fun. You know, I'm at a conference and I'm collecting passwords, but, you know, fortunately I'm not doing anything with them except showing people that their passwords are there. But I think it helps to wake people up and helps to show them where they're at.
So talking about the community, especially in the US and in North America. So we mentioned the Schmoo group, but of course there are other groups as well, partly revolving around the conferences themselves, like the DEF CON crowd, or like the more traditional or long-time groups like 2600.
Sure.
How would you say is the interrelationship and communication among these scenes? Are very different, difficult? Mm. What are your experiences?
Well, I think a small group of hackers like the Schmoo group gives you a resource. You know, like I will, I will ask questions of that. I mean, there's like 40 people in the Schmoo group, and that's a group of friends. You know, a lot of them I only ever see at conferences. Some of them have never even met each other. You know, I'm not probably the only one who's actually met every other Schmoo. And the thing about it is that, you know, that's like a group of friends who we get to trust each other and get to know each other and work on projects together, and we discuss a lot of things. You know, I find out, I learn a great deal about the current state of security issues from them. Most of them work 100% professionally as computer security industry folks, and so, you know, at any given time, I probably know as much as anyone about what's going on in security just because I'm hanging out with them. And anybody could replicate that. I mean, I think, and that's what people should do is, you know, the Schmoo group's probably as big as we need to get it because it's, you know, these things have growing pains, but anybody could make a group of 10 or 20 people who they met and thought shared their interests. And I think that, you know, the internet's obviously making that useful. Conferences are a great way to spend some time together and improve upon the shortcomings of email and instant messenger. And then, you know, figure out what you want to do together. And that's what we did. And I see that happening in other groups. You know, we had really close relationship with the Ghetto Hackers, which was another kind of notorious hacker group. And but they, you know, also very ad hoc, but they did some fantastic things. They ended up running the Capture the Flag contest, which is hacker contest at DEF CON for several years. They won it for 3 years in a row, and then they ran the contest for 3 years in a row, and then retired from that. And then you know, there are other, you know, sort of other hacker groups like that, and they wax and wane, but they have their own value to the, especially to the members, you know.
So we're talking about internal communications within the group.
Sure.
So you definitely mentioned like the internet, and of course it's the obvious space of communication. Is there any kind of physical space to meet apart from conferences?
Well,
like
clubs
or other meeting places?
In Seattle in particular, we have been pretty lucky because Microsoft is importing lots of security experts. And so we have kind of a critical mass of hackers. And in our case, we started with the 2600 meeting, which is each month. And in a lot of U.S. cities, there's a 2600 meeting. But we ended up with a pretty big one. And then we always have a party each month after 2600, and we call it 2621. And we'll invite new people sometimes to come out and party with us each the first Friday of every month in Seattle. And now I think it's famous. I mean, I think, you know, hackers from all over the world, whenever they come to Seattle, they come to 2621. So we always have a flow of interesting people coming through.
And what is it called, 2621?
I think it was supposed to be for the 21 and over crowd, because there's a lot, you know, we go out and get drinks. But that's pretty loosely enforced, I think. So it's you know, for us, we've been really, you know, lucky, but we have to put some effort into fostering that community. You know, like when we went to, you know, for a while at 2600, we always would ask whoever wanted to speak about something. So we'd get somebody speaking, and it can be any, it could be a 15-year-old kid talking about, you know, learning how to write a compression algorithm. You know, I mean, those are, anything goes at those meetings. They're, if you go to a 2600 meeting in most cities, it's just going to be a few geeks sitting around at a coffee shop with their laptops. And so, you know, you take that and say, well, how do we make this a little more valuable to us? And the answer might be to have somebody give talks or to choose a project to work on together. And again, in Seattle, we got pretty lucky because I think we have some great folks around and great hackers around. And Eric Johansson and I have a lab that we have a hacker bot. We call it the Hacker Bot Lab, and we build robots and things, and each Saturday, and everybody's invited, and all kinds of people come over and work on crazy robot projects and stuff at our lab, and it's helping build the community. And I actually brought I completely forgot to mention it on stage, but I brought a robot that we built in the lab to DLD with me, and it's called the Drawbot. It's a little robot that you feed it photographs, and it tries to draw them. It's kind of fun. I'm going to set it up a little later, maybe tomorrow or something.
So you're pretty much into these hands-on things.
Yeah, I am. I think
also, always have been part of the hacker culture.
True, but I think it's endangered, you know?
You think so?
Yeah, I think there's a ton of interest. And especially in the U.S., we have Make Magazine, some of those guys.
Yeah, especially that's what I wanted to mention. Make Magazine was launched. When was it, like
about a year ago?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think they have tremendous success in collecting lots of stuff, which is like more than you can read if you just follow the blog.
It's true.
So I think there's a lot of things out there that
has
to come together.
Well, in a way, like the Drawbot is a Make project, because you know, the Make Magazine guys hang out at our lab and they built it there, and that's to me, it's wonderful. I mean, I think Make is wonderful, and I think there's a you know, a yearning for this kind of hands-on and do-it-yourself kind of thing, and Make is just showing people what's possible in ways that they didn't imagine, and so I'm totally enthusiastic about that. What I mean by endangered is that even, you know, the reason Make looks successful is because it's easy for them, relatively easy for them to find the kind of people who are interested in it all over the U.S. in particular, maybe all over the world. I don't know what their distribution looks like. But we have to win converts. You know, we have to find ways to get to those kids and those people who otherwise would never see Make Magazine, would never do those kinds of things. And right now, I think what we're doing is we're starting by just the people who already know. You know, I mean, I'm not in no way saying Make's not doing that, but it's, they're at the beginning of that still. And it's not just their problem, it's all of ours, you know. And what I mean by endangered in particular is that, you know, products these days, the way they're made, are far less observable in the way that they work. So when I was a kid, I could flip a toaster over and take out the screws and open it up, and I could see the springs inside and see the mechanism and see how it worked. Well, now, you know, you get a toaster and it's glued together. And if you break it open, you're going to find a little green circuit board in there. And all the mechanical principles are embodied in electronics. And so because of that, it makes it, I think it makes it a lot harder to learn, you know, because you can't learn from your environment around you. You know, learning how a toaster from a book, come on, that's no fun. Nobody's going to do that. Learning how it works, I mean, that doesn't make any sense. And so because of the way we develop products, we're building a world that where lots of knowledge is getting lost. And it's not that we don't know how to make a wind-up toaster. It's just that kids aren't going to be exposed to that. They're, you know, instead they're being exposed to very complicated things, and they can't see the building blocks that make them. And so that's why I say it's kind of endangered. It's not that we won't always have smart people, and it's not that we won't always have Wikipedia to tell us how a wind-up toaster worked. It's just that, you know, to make it part of yourself, you have to experience it. It's much different, and that kind of learning, is much different than the learning you get reading in a book. So, you know, even like working at Blue, we're building spaceships, but the idea there is to try and, you know, make a spacecraft that can take people to space. But it's a hard problem because we can read in books about how rockets are built, and we can read everything about what NASA's always done, but the truth is, you got to do it yourself. You know, you got to go through it. You got to experience it. So that's what Blues does. You know, we build one ship, test it out, see how that goes, build the next one, test it out. You know, we're getting a little better each time. And I think that's how people, you know, really learn and how groups really learn. I mean, in that process of building spaceships, we learn how to work together. We learn what, you know, kind of time it takes and what kind of costs, and we learn things that don't work. And we could have read all that in a book. We did read all the books that tell you, but it's different. It's a different feeling that you get when you do things yourselves. And so, you know, like one thing I meant to tell people here on stage is that, you know, I know they all have VCRs at home somewhere. They're not using them to watch VHS tapes. Just get a fucking screwdriver and take it apart and see how it works. I mean, the ejection mechanism on a VCR is
amazing.
Is amazing. It's unreal. And the head is this really shiny metal electromagnet thing. I mean, I think the heads in VCRs are really cool. You know, people have probably never seen that. Just take it apart. It's not like you need a VCR. You know, you have it. It's probably the last thing you'll ever have that's worth taking apart. So do it, you know?
Yeah, right.
Anyway.
So to wrap up, yeah. I know that, well, you're based in the U.S. and sure. Lots of your activities are probably based there. But yeah. I know you've been around. You've also been to one of our Chaos Communication conferences. What are your experiences with hacker scenes outside of North America?
Well, I think it's wonderful. I mean, when we first came to Germany, we were, for CCC, we were just amazed at the, you know, these crazy German hackers and things like the C-Base. And the things that they have done there, it's just wonderful. It's delightful, you know. And also, I mean, we've seen some really scary stuff they did. I mean, there's hackers in Germany that we saw doing some of the really early work on hacking cell phones cell phone exploits and things, you know, stuff that we hadn't even played with. It's really amazing. So I'm impressed. I love it. But the truth is, yeah, I can't say that I think that we're in touch, you know. I mean, we, you know, if you guys demo some cool new attack, we're going to read about it on, you know, on Slashdot probably or some other blog. But that's about, which is a good start, you know. But, and I think there's some cross-pollination between the groups, but.
I agree. It's lacking some kind of global networking, which is kind of funny.
But that may be okay.
Hackers were always, you know, coming up with this meme of the global village and the ever interconnectedness, and in the end, they're probably the last one to interconnect.
Right, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah, but I really think we can improve on that, and I definitely see improvements in the last years. So, and apart from Europe, any insight into Asian or other scenes?
I can't say I'm particularly connected outside of the U.S. and Europe. And I think, you know, I would love to be, because I see some hints of amazing things. I mean, I know that, I mean, if you look in China, you've got hackers who are on the government payroll. They have websites where they're talking about the stuff they're doing. They don't publish any of their exploits. They don't report anything. They're using the same operating system we are, and we don't ever hear about the stuff they find. And I think that, to me, it's like both intriguing and scary. You know, I mean, I think there's probably a lot more Chinese hackers than there are American hackers. And we're at the beginning of understanding what that means, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely lacking this specific kind of history that both the U.S. and definitely also Europe had in growing up with technology. So these things are not like 30 years around.
Yeah, sure.
Just bumping into it, and everything is developing pretty fast. So they just almost can't keep up with the development that is coming out right now. Yeah, but we were taking a closer look at this as well in the future. So I say thank you, Pablos, for this very interesting talk, and I hope we can meet you at our conferences
My
other
pleasure.
Conferences
well, I hope so.
much more, probably at the camp in August. That would definitely
be a
place to like have this made things, like real installation, the hands-on imperative coming back to the hacker scene.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you and goodbye.
Okay, thanks.